Good evening, everyone. Welcome, comrades and friends, to Workers World Party's weekly broadcast, where hundreds of revolutionaries from around the world gather to strategize, to analyze, and to build the struggle for a socialist future for a workers' world. Tonight, we are so excited to be joined by comrade Professor Vijay Prashad, the executive director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. He is the author of 30 books, I believe, more, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and No Free Left, The Futures of Indian Communism, and contributed to the recent anthology collection, Capitalism on a Ventilator, The Impact of COVID-19 in China and the U.S. My name is Ted Kelly from the Philadelphia branch of Workers' World Party and co-editor, along with Miranda Chrisman, of Tear Down the Walls. And without further ado, I would love now to introduce Vijay Prashad. Welcome, comrade. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Yes. Great. Great to be with you. Yeah.
Thank you. So let's get right into it. The subject tonight is about vaccine imperialism, vaccine apartheid. We know that the United States has hundreds of military bases around the world. The U.S. assassinates and overthrows governments with impunity, mm-hmm. imposes sanctions on a third of the entire population of the planet. Your most recent book, Washington Bullets, is a history of these kind of atrocities. But the empire also has other mechanisms to retain its stranglehold over the global South. And I was wondering if you could talk about the methods by which it's imposed this vaccine apartheid through intellectual property and patent law, but also just to tell us about the situation in India right now.
It's great to be here. First thing that we should know is that this pandemic started in January 2020. That's when the WHO declares it as an emergency, a public health emergency, late January. On the 11th of March, the Director General of the WHO, Dr. Tedros, says that it's a pandemic. This is a significant event. There was plenty of time. The United States was informed in late December 2019 by China CDC that there is something happening in Wuhan. It's quite disturbing. You need to know about it. And in fact, Dr. George Gao, the head of China CDC, was crying on the phone when he spoke to the head of US CDC. This is reported in the New York Times, actually. So there was advance warning. And the advanced capitalist countries just did not follow basic protocol. And I want to start here, Ted, because this is important. The WHO said that based on their assessment, it was the 20th of January when they figured out that this particular virus could go from human to human. Human to human transmission actually is what triggers the public health emergency on the 28th of January. And then eventually March 11th, the pandemic. They only figured out human-to-human transmission on the 20th of January. When they figured out human-to-human transmission, they basically said, listen, you need to wash your hands, you need to maintain some physical distance, you need to wear a mask. Vietnam, which shares a very long border with China and is actually within bus ride distance of Hubei province, which is the province home to Wuhan city, Vietnam immediately decided that they need to do a public relations campaign. They created a very cute little song about washing hands. And, you know, in fact, the song was so cute, people were mimicking it on TikTok. And they were able, in a sense, to break the chain of the infection very quickly. Look, Vietnam has had nothing like the infection or casualty rate of the United States or Brazil or India. So very simple method, they were able to slow down the spread of the virus, of the disease. And then, you know, their healthcare capacity was not overrun and so on. It's important to start there, Ted, because it also buys you time as you begin to understand this virus, as you begin to develop a vaccine and so on. If you do basic things, you can buy time to confront a public health challenge. That's what the WHO said. India did nothing. Mr. Narendra Modi basically told the public, go out in public and bang pots and yell, Corona go, Corona jao, Corona jao, Corona jao. It's ridiculous. You know, it's fantastic. They didn't follow basic protocols. The United States, Trump kept saying, there's no Corona, it's a Chinese virus, racist stuff. You know, no basic adherence to science and rationality. Same in the United Kingdom, same in Italy and Brazil. The Mr. Bolsonaro is barely a leader. He's like a thug. And so you had chaos in these advanced capitalist countries. So interesting that in the socialist countries, in Cuba, in Venezuela, in Vietnam, in Laos, the governments acted with an immense amount of responsibility. This was also true in capitalist countries with a reasonably strong state, where the state hadn't been destroyed by neoliberalism, such as New Zealand, such as South Korea. You know, let's face it, these countries hadn't destroyed the state system in the same way as, say, India has. India spends 1.3% of its GDP on healthcare. That's a shambles. You know, it's way below any acceptable number. Way below any acceptable number. 1.3% of the GDP on healthcare. If you don't have the health and education of your public, why have a government? You know, why have a... India is the largest importer of weapons. So this was the immediate problem, that these countries didn't take the basic protocol seriously. Number two, over the years, because of this 1.3% of GDP expenditure in India and the low expenditure in the US, public health systems have been destroyed. Healthcare has been treated as a commodity. You privatized healthcare. India has the largest out-of-pocket healthcare systems in the world. That is, people just don't have any insurance, no public insurance, social insurance, nothing. They have to pay every time they see a doctor. It's the largest out-of-pocket in the world. Imagine that. It's outrageous. You know, poor country with out-of-pocket healthcare system. So they destroy public health. And by the way, none of this is something you realize afterwards. In 1978, at the Alma Ata meeting of the WHO, there's the Alma Ata Declaration. Alma Ata was a town in the USSR. In Alma Ata, there was a declaration passed by the WHO for public health protocols. If you go back online, read Alma Ata Declaration, and you'll see that, look, they had all the ideas already there. You don't need a pandemic of this scale to teach you the lessons of Alma Ata. You should have learned them before, but no, you destroyed your public health systems. That's the second point. And the third point is you don't have the capacity, public sector production capacity, to immediately ramp up the production of ventilators, to ramp up the production of oxygen-making kits, none of that. You rely on the private sector and you don't direct the private sector. You see, if you think about it, Ted, sometime around October of last year, when it became clear that there were vaccine lines, when it became clear, each of these countries, if they had a socialist system, would have directed the public sector to immediately start producing raw materials for the vaccines and so on. But you can't. Finally, on vaccines, which is very important, India has only vaccinated 2% of the public. At the current rate, my colleagues say, at the current rate of vaccination, India will not vaccinate before November 2022. I know you're in a pandemic. You're living through a fog. We've just finished 2020. I don't know if you remember that this is 2021. I understand the calendar got screwed up during the pandemic. This is May 2021, flash. India will not vaccinate before November 2022. We're not even near November 2021. We're talking a whole year and several months. Why? Why is this the case? India produces 60% of the world's vaccines. 60% of the world's vaccine produced in India. Why? Couple of reasons. One, Indian pharma is not going to produce vaccines unless the patent license is removed. And the reason is because Indian pharmaceutical companies rely on sales to the very lucrative US market. They don't want to get sanctioned if they break intellectual property. So they're not willing to do it, even though they can. Why don't they go ahead and produce the public sector produced Chinese vaccine or the public sector produced Russian vaccine? They're afraid of being sanctioned by US and European pharma companies. Second reason they can't do it is the United States in 1950, during the US brutal war against the people of Korea, during that war, the US passed an act called the Defense Production Act. Donald Trump triggered the Defense Production Act, which prevents the export of certain raw materials for vaccines out of the US, including certain kinds of plastic bags. Because of that, Biden has not waived that, by the way. Biden is enforcing the Defense Production Act. So these pharma companies cannot ramp up production. You know, so what is the catastrophe in India? It's a terrible government, It's decades of austerity and privatization, and it's the imperialist bloc on vaccine production that should be happening at a public health level, not at a pandemic profiteering level.
And it's fascinating to hear you say, too, about the sort of immediate life-saving measures that were taken in countries like Vietnam, where even before we know how to create a vaccine, we know that we can use, the state can use its mass media to put out public service announcements, like you're saying, and can impose the sort of normal restrictions once we realize that it's a human-to-human contact. None of these things were done, like you said, in these developed capitalist countries. And that's why one of the things that you and others who contributed to Capitalism on a Ventilator have really showed this stark difference in responding to crises like this. And I think going forward, we're seeing the structural inability of capitalism to deal with crises on this scale. You've also written about the trap of charity from the global north. And it reminded me of something that Thomas Sankara said in a speech, saying that this type of assistance is counterproductive. And the one who feeds you usually imposes his will on you. And how, you know, Burkina Faso did not need food coming in bags, it needed irrigation equipment and science. And I wonder what role has institutions like the Gates Foundation and other groups like this played in all of this during the COVID crisis?
I'm glad you raised Sankara, because one of the things Sankara did, apart from the fact that he created a dignified state structure in the country of Burkina Faso, which he named, it's called a land of dignified people, upright people. It's a great name for a country which is not going to bow its shoulders down and beg you for anything. They did mass vaccination programs under Sankara. They vaccinated the whole population. They decided that this is not a joke. You know, look, I mean, there are a lot of people who don't believe in vaccines. You're entitled to your opinion, but you really need to have a studied opinion. You know, like polio, that's a serious vaccine. You know, it's I think a danger to your children not to vaccinate them against things like polio and so on. And people will say, oh, I don't believe in vaccine. They are going to implant microchips. I spoke to a doctor about this in India. I said, you know, he said, look, that stuff is just not true. But the most interesting answer he gave me when I said, which is the best vaccine? He said, the best vaccine is the one you're offered. The best vaccine is the one you're offered. Take it. I want to say a couple of things, Ted. First, I want to say India is in the middle of an emergency. Up to 400,000 cases, confirmed cases of COVID per day. And that's an undercount. The death rate, we don't even know. Cemeteries are clogged. Yesterday at the cemeteries in Delhi, there were lines of bodies waiting like taxis at an airport. There are lines of people waiting outside hospitals, basically hoping that somebody will die inside there. Imagine the civilization we live in. Imagine the civilization where somebody is standing outside a hospital, hoping somebody is going to die. This is like, you know, in an advanced country, you're standing outside a restaurant, looking at somebody saying, finish your meal and leave. That's one thing. This is quite another. You want somebody to die so you can go in and get treated. And then that person dies, there's a queue to get cremated. At this point right now, if Bill Gates says to me, I'm going to rent 20 jumbo jets and send AstraZeneca vaccines or send ventilators, I'll say, go ahead. I have no problem with you right now. Right now, you want to, any charity foundation wants to hire planes and send oxygen making machines, send them. India is in the middle of a crisis. This is no time for us to play long-term politics and so on. Right now, anything goes. The US government wants to send its infernal warships and produce oxygen. Go ahead and do it now. It doesn't matter. This is an emergency. You know, people I know, people are dying, and it's not that kind of situation. You understand? Right now, everything must be done. In the middle of an emergency, we must say, you release all laws and do everything. And that's why the release of the waiver at the WTO is so important. That's why removing the Defense Production Act. People ask me, you know, I'm in the United States, what can I do for India? I say, you start a campaign immediately, a mass campaign. The Defense Production Act restrictions must be removed immediately. That's it. You don't need your dollars. Don't need your dollars. You need political help. Political solidarity is much more important than the few dollars you can send. You know, that point I'll make, I think it's important because people forget. They think their money, their charity is enough. It's not. Your political solidarity is more important. People of Cuba need, yes, syringes. There is a campaign now to raise money for 20 million syringes for Cuba. You can find the campaign online. Two Cuba campaigns I want to promote. One is the Cuban doctors must get the Nobel Prize. It's called Cuba Nobel. Secondly, syringes for Cuba. Just Google syringes for Cuba. You need to go out there and raise. Yes, at the same time, come on, we need to argue that this illegal criminal blockade is lifted off the island of Cuba. It is lifted so that the Cuban people can finally breathe after what? After one of the longest wars the United States has prosecuted. You know, there's chatter now, the United States withdrawing from Afghanistan. Noam Chomsky and I have just released a very interesting article. I hope you'll find it interesting, where we call it the United States withdraws from Afghanistan, ? Not really. Not really. That's our argument, because they are not withdrawing. People say it's the longest wars. Not true. The longest wars that the United States continued to prosecute are against Korea. That war has never ended. And the war against Cuba never ended. So yes, we need relief. We need to fight politically. Yes. And then we wonder, why do we have a civilization where we allow for a no tax regime? Billionaires hoard trillions. You know, Jeff Bezos wants to be the world's first trillionaire. Hundreds of billions of dollars they sit on. The 2,000 billionaires in the world made over, I think, 54% of their wealth increased during the pandemic. They make trillions of dollars cumulatively. And then they give a tiny fraction as philanthropy. We are meant to pray to them, thanking them for their fraction of the money, you know, that they give. And they want buildings named after them, foundations named after them. I don't want their charity. I want their taxes. They need to be taxed at a fair rate. They don't need so much surplus value in their pocket. That kind of surplus value is obscene. They need to be taxed so that the money can be used democratically. See, the problem with philanthropy is undemocratic giving, because they get to choose where the money goes. Why should Bill Gates get to choose where the social wealth is going? That's not his money. That's social wealth. Now, there's two ways to distribute the social wealth. One is the billionaire decides what to do with it. And the second is the public decides what to do with it. Now, in the United States, the people don't control the government. So I quite understand. It's not exactly democratic, but it's a lot more democratic than having charity dictate, you know, where the money goes. So I'm in general not in favor of charity, even in a society where the government is not fully democratic, like in the United States. It's not a democracy as such. It's a sort of representative guided system of the elites. Fine. In that system, it's still more democratic than allowing one person or two people to dictate the terms. You know, even better to have a socialist system where there is a different, more robust decision-making process. You know, like in Kerala, it's all people's planning. Everybody gets a say in discussing and debating and so on. So that's the part of it. You know, if the people were able to decide actually, Ted, in any society, people would say, I would prefer to have good public health systems and good public education for my children. These are far more important to me, far more important than buying some major weapon system or subsidizing a big company or whatever it is. You know, you go nuts in a country if you keep subsidizing big business and you don't provide basic services to people, you know, basic services. I mean, what is socialism? What is socialism? Is the provision basically of basic services and the provision of leisure so that the people can make history. That's all that socialism is. Socialism is the provision of basic services through the state, operation of some kind of the high command of the economy, and then leisure. That's what we want. We want leisure so we can make history. Right now, people are working 16-hour days, 12-hour days. There's no leisure in capitalism. This is interesting. I had a conversation earlier today. I'm sorry, I'm going on in an odd tangential way. I had a conversation earlier about socialism, the Soviet socialism. And I was thinking very much about the idea of scarcity and abundance. You know, how people said in the Soviet Union, there was a scarcity of goods. People were in queues and so on. I remember seeing those pictures of Texas where people were in queues in their cars to get food relief. There are queues in the United States. They're just not queues for the elite. There are queues for the working class and the systematically unemployed. Anyway, let's leave that aside for a minute, Ted. I was saying that, yes, in the United States, there's an abundance of goods, but there's a scarcity of access. anybody can see that supermarkets are full, but people can't access them. You can't access the Ferraris and the diamond shops and all that. The goods are all available. You can't access them. In the USSR, yes, in many times there was a scarcity of goods, but there was no scarcity of access. Everybody got housing. Everybody got a reasonable amount of food through basic provisioning. That was all there. You, yes, had queues for certain things, but that's because there was a scarcity of goods, but not there was abundance of access. In a capitalist country of abundance of goods and scarcity of access, you tell me which you would prefer.
And we can see in throughout history, when these actual socialist revolutions have taken place, how the management of resources has changed. In Cuba, the literacy rate skyrocketing, the per capita number of teachers and doctors. And I'm glad that you mentioned just one of the recent examples of these crises cropping up in with the Texas freeze. A little later, we're going to be hearing from Marinda Christman, who's based in Houston. And they were one of many people who experienced the firsthand degeneration of the infrastructure in this crumbling empire. You mentioned the waiver of patent protections for vaccines, but I'm so glad that you also mentioned the alleged withdrawal, plan to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. And just 2 days ago, Biden advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci said that forcing drug companies to abandon intellectual property rights to COVID-19 vaccines would backfire. It would lead to long disputes. He opposed any plan to, quote, rip up international trade rules. But then just yesterday, the Biden administration made some announcement that they were considering waiving these patent rules. Tellingly, that caused a drop in the stock prices for big pharmaceutical corporations like Merck and Pfizer. Pfizer, who is seen, like so many, you know, billionaire corporations, massive windfalls during this pandemic. But the Biden administration double talk is now well known. The support for the genocide in Yemen, they said they were going to stop that. That was not actually true. The plan to withdraw U.S. soldiers from Afghanistan seems extremely unlikely. Even the $2,000 checks that U.S. workers were promised during the campaign ended up not being the case. So what are the chances that the Biden administration actually goes forward with this waiver for vaccine development?
Right. So I want to talk about two things, Ted. One is patents and the other is production, because these are in a way related. And when I get to production, I want to talk about Russia and China, and to some extent Cuba, because I think that's important. First, I think it's important for people to know that until 1986 to 1994, the Uruguay round of the General Agreement of Trade and Tariffs, until then, it's interesting what was patented. Let me try to give you an example. Well, I don't have a good example here, but imagine I'm holding a packet of medicines in my hand. And what was patented until the Uruguay round of the General Agreement of Trade and Tariffs in the 1980s was the process of producing the medicine. So if this is a medicine for, I don't know, headaches, the process of the medicine was patented, not the medicine itself, which meant that a country like India could take the medicine, reverse engineer it, find a different way to make the medicine, and that was acceptable. It's known as process patenting. Then in the Uruguay round, entering the WTO in 1994, you had product patenting. The product itself was patented. This actually stifles innovation, because when you reverse engineer a drug, you can find a better way to make it. Actually, it increases scientific inquiry and so on. So actual TRIPS and TRIMS is the names of these procedures, trade-related intellectual property rights. They actually stifle innovation in this way. So that's the first thing to remember. Secondly, inside the world of the WTO, there's been an enormous debate around two fronts. One is on AIDS drugs. In 2003, India, Brazil, South Africa got together at Cancun and created a bloc called IBSA, India, Brazil, South Africa. This was the first grouping that later becomes BRICS in 2009. But BRICS starts with India, Brazil, South Africa, 2003. Brazil puts in motion a law that allows it to basically invalidate international patents. South Africa followed and India joined them saying, we will produce AIDS drugs and give it to you at a low price. And this was very significant. Bill Clinton, by the way, opposed it publicly, as he has opposed this particular patent waiver. I'm getting to Bill Clinton in a second, Ted, because people may not remember his culpability, his criminal act around this. So the first thing to recall then is the AIDS drug issue, the AIDS cocktail, was a slight attack to poke at patent law. It didn't succeed. They were able to get away with it because the AIDS crisis had raised in the North, in United States, Canada, in Europe, and so on, a constituency developed that defended the rights of third world countries to break the patent laws, a constituently developed. Some of this was helped along by ACT UP and others who really fought hard to enable this to happen. Okay, so that's important. But it didn't actually disrupt the rigid patent wall that had been created by Big Pharma. So that's one. Second thing is in various phases, but as recently as 2015, the WTO committee that looks at these issues agreed that less developed countries have a right to break patent laws. And they extended this till 2033. So from 2015 to 2033, the less developed country isn't a pejorative term. It's a term of art, meaning it's an acceptable designation in the WTO framework. And certain countries are on a list called LDCs. And they are now allowed to go off patent and create medicines. Okay, so that's the first thing about patents. Related to this, yesterday, Catherine Tai, the US trade representative, she basically said that the United States is willing to go into negotiations in the WTO committee around patent withdrawal for the vaccines. They didn't actually say it should be waived. You got to remember that that committee operates on consensus. So the United States knows somebody is going to oppose it there. Somebody is going to carry the suitcase for Big Pharma and it'll be imposed. So I think the headlines are wrong today. The headlines generally said Biden administration finally says patent waiver can go through. I don't think that's true. If you look closely at Catherine Tai's statement, it says we are willing to go into negotiation. So I don't know where the New York Times and others, they are basically in that liberal haze where they don't want to see the realities, you know, that exist. Okay, so Ted, that's the patent side of it, right? Let's come to production for a minute. These less developed countries are allowed until 2033 to make drugs, but only one LDC, only one LDC has the capacity to make drugs, and that's Bangladesh. So what's the point of having a waiver when nobody has a production capacity? So this is part of the whole destruction of the public sector pharmaceutical industry in the world. I said I'd come back to Bill Clinton. You may remember that when Bill Clinton was in the middle, the thick of the crisis around Monica Lewinsky and so on, he bombed Afghanistan and he bombed Sudan. People may remember this, an illegal act, no UN resolution. He bombed Sudan. What resolution did he bomb Sudan on? He bombed a factory in Khartoum, accusing it of being a terror factory. That was the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical factory. It's the only pharmaceutical factory in Sudan, was destroyed by Bill Clinton, never rebuilt. Sudan today does not have the capacity to make medicines, thanks to Bill Clinton. When are people like this going to be called account for their criminal activity? I mean, that's a criminal act. It's an act where he was trying to defray attention from a legal case in Washington, D.C., where he's accused of essentially sexual harassment in the workplace. And he destroys the pharmaceutical factory in Sudan, where now the Sudanese people have access to no medication. You know, people are hot and bothered about what's happening in Xinjiang. I would like you to pay attention to your own government for a minute, destroying the only pharmaceutical factory in a majority Muslim country. You're so worried about Muslims. What about the Al-Shifa factory? When did the United States return and build a factory there? Never, 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 actually, never. Destroyed factories in Afghanistan. When were those rebuilt? Never, actually. Destroyed the leather and date industry in Iraq. When were those rebuilt? Never, just to put it plainly. Destroyed the Iraqi date trees because of something like napalm and so on. What? Who is going to recover all this? Okay, leave that. Production facilities. You see, that's the key thing that should be on the agenda now. It's not enough to call for the patent waiver. That's an immediate short-term thing. We are demanding it. We are demanding Defense Production Act be removed. But we also need public sector pharmaceutical production to be built in third world countries. And it shouldn't be built in every country. You know, we need to have The UN Conference on Trade and Development, the United Nations Development Program, the IMF, all of them need to come to a conference because they have money, okay? I think the IMF is a bunch of crooks, but they have money. They are holding our standard drawing rights. Our money is held in an IMF account, okay? I think they're a bunch of crooks. I've written a lot of books talking about them, but they still hold my money. You know, they still hold money of the third world. That money needs to be put on the table. A plan needs to be created. In the African Union, for instance, there needs to be a consideration of having regions. Horn of Africa, build up pharmaceutical capacity. It's not just about this COVID-19 vaccine, Ted. You see, we have been told by scientists there will be catastrophic health events coming in the future. I mean, I'm all in favor for the creation, just like we have an intergovernmental committee on climate change. I'm all in favor of an intergovernmental committee on health threats. Why not have one on health threats? If we have one on health threats, it could direct the African Union, assist the African Union, for instance, to build pharmaceutical production capacity in a regional basis. Southern Africa, build capacity. Western Africa, build capacity. Northern Africa, build capacity. It also will build relations between neighbors, you see. Very important thing. We don't have that on the table. So lifting the waiver is one thing. Now, coming to China, Russia. The European and American vaccine companies say we would prefer to flood the market in India with our vaccines, which India will buy, rather than lift the waiver. And rather than allow public sector vaccines from Russia, Sputnik, and Sinovac from China to enter. See, they don't want the growth of the public sector pharma. They would like their pharma to sell around the world. The point isn't to sell European and US and so on vaccines, whether produced in India or not, because as I said, India produces 60% of the world's vaccines. Whether India produces it or not, we don't want these companies to be dominating in perpetuity. We want to build public sector capacity. That's the key thing. I am not embarrassed to talk about rebuilding the public sector. Basically, neoliberalism and privatization have totally failed. They have driven a stake through the heart of humanity. We need to return to the public sector on key things like health, education, elder care, that kind of thing. We need the public sector.
And I'm so glad that you mentioned so many of these things, particularly the production aspect, which is similar to what we were talking about earlier when we were talking about Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso. And the sort of bourgeois legalisms and the mechanisms by which the Biden administration and other governments can sort of get around not being forced to do some of the, you know, like the PRO Act provisions to safeguard union organizing rights. That could have been implemented through an executive order if Biden really wanted to do that. Same thing with acting on vaccine patents, as you know, we were talking about with Sarah Flounders earlier today. These could be done. But we also, we could spend a whole hour, if not longer, talking about the crimes of the William Jefferson Clinton administration. And I just think that, you know, workers in the belly of the beast, it should be an embarrassment to us that these criminals are walking around with impunity and that we have not organized enough power to actually hold these people responsible for uncountable deaths, just in the case of the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical plant. So I'm so glad that you mentioned all these things. I'm just going to make two quick announcements before we get to our next question, comrade. Workers' World newspaper has been in continuous circulation since 1959. During the first months of the COVID-19 pandemic, the print edition was temporarily suspended, but we're happy that we're printing our newspaper again on a monthly basis. You can subscribe to receive Workers' World newspaper by email at workers.org. And also, each week we run our section, Tear Down the Walls, which is about the struggle for the abolition of the prison industrial complex. The Prisoner Solidarity Committee has a long history of solidarity with imprisoned members of our class, from our inside report from the Attica Uprising in 1971 to our weekly coverage today. We provide free subscriptions to anyone who's currently incarcerated, so you can support that program at patreon.com/WWP. Comrade, you've also written about how China has dealt with the COVID-19 virus. And, you know, we talked about Vietnam and other socialist countries. A couple of your articles in Capitalism on a Ventilator, The Impact of COVID-19 in China and the US, are about this subject. And I wonder if you can compare this to India's experience, specifically about the relationship between India and China right now? You know, you mentioned that India has been manufacturing millions of doses of the vaccine. That's a huge part of the world's vaccine production. Can you talk about what India's relationship with China is like right now?
It's a depressing subject, actually. It's not easy to talk about because India and China are neighbors, historic neighbors. Both countries, roughly 1.4, 1.5 billion populations, enormous. If you add India and China, it's 3 billion people. There's about 7.9 billion people in the planet. Indians and Chinese number almost half of them, okay? That's amazing. It's huge populations. Both India and China win their independence, as it were, at the same time. India in 1947, China in 1949. Now, China in 1949 was in worse shape than India in 47, because you have to remember, China's World War II started in 1937 at the Marco Polo Bridge incident. In fact, you can go back earlier when the Japanese first come and seize parts of Manchuria. You might even go earlier. But anyway, let's just start in 1937. And it effectively ends, even though World War II ends in 1945, China's World War II ends in 1949. When the Communist Party enters Beijing and Chiang Kai-shek and co run to Taiwan. So that is a 12-year war. Let me ask you, I don't know how good your mathematics is, Ted, but let's imagine the United States enters World War II in December of 1941, correct? So let's not count 1941. It's 1942, 1943, 1944, and a part of 45. So the United States was at war, Second World War, for about 3.5 years. China was in World War II for 12 years. Okay, just breathe that in. Chinese physical plant infrastructure was destroyed. In fact, some of it was destroyed by Chiang Kai-shek, who blew up a dam and flooded an entire province and killed, you know, I don't know, over 1 million people died because of that maneuver so that they could then retreat from the Japanese troops. It was like a slash and burn. No, what's that called? Something retreat, you know, where you burn things and...
Scorched earth.
Scorched earth, yeah. Correct. Thanks a lot. Scorched earth, except here you weren't burning, you were flooding. And huge number of death and so on. Country was destroyed. In India, yes, there was destruction, but the colonial powers, for whatever reason, had built up an industrial plant, had allowed Indian capitalism to emerge, you know, in steel, iron and steel, mining and so on. So in a sense, India was in a better position in 47. But what is the difference between the two? Today, for instance, China has this year abolished poverty. Everybody agrees with that. There is not one bourgeois agency in the world that says that's a lie. Everybody said it's true. They have abolished poverty. Absolute poverty gone. India, half the population lives in poverty. What the Chinese did, what the Mao era did was they first improved basic living conditions of people, health, nutrition, and basic sense of dignity in life. That's what socialism in a poor country gives you. Let's be fair. All socialist experiments have taken place in poor countries, actual socialist experiments, from the October Revolution to Burkina Faso to Cuba and so on. Not one of the advanced capitalist countries, contradictory to what Marx had written, not one of the advanced capitalist countries had a revolution. It was all poor countries, you know, Vietnam, so on, peasant countries that had a revolution. So the one of the axioms of making a revolution is that you have the people strengthening their shoulders and feeling like it's their own country. They don't have to take permission to walk on their land, Ted. That's the main thing. That's what the Mao era gives people. And because it's a poor country, you have to increase the productive forces. So from the 78 reforms onward, China has been zigzagging. I've talked to so many people in the Chinese communist movement who'll say, look, we don't want to socialize poverty, okay? It's easy for people in the United States to say, oh, you've come back to capitalism or whatever. I mean, you're talking from a position in that sense of privilege. You know, this is a poor country. We have to create some wealth. So we are zigzagging between increasing the productive forces and then socializing the wealth. In Xi Jinping time, it's zagged back to socializing the wealth, you know, driving a kind of equality agenda. Yes, there are times when they've gone too far in the other direction. It's like, you know, I suppose trying to manage a boat in the water. You keep testing the wind going one way and the other. It's an experiment. I mean, Vietnam is struggling with that. You know, how do you build wealth? You don't want to go in the Pol Pot direction. You don't want to socialize poverty and create a brutal society like that. Please, we don't want that. I'm sorry. There may be people who think that's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea at all. And I think the Chinese leadership does not believe it's a good idea. So China has built up its state structure. They didn't ossify, destroy their state structure. It's true. that during the reform era, they cut back on public health badly, badly. During SARS, they realized that they had made a huge mistake in destroying public health systems. Huge mistake. Because they had. That was a terrible mistake. Listen, I'm not a... People say you're an apologist for the Chinese government. No, when there is a problem, you must criticize it. But criticize on facts, not on hallucination. And by the way, Chinese criticize themselves for this. Then you pivot, you start rebuilding healthcare. So by the time you got the COVID diagnosis of human-to-human transmission, look at what they did in Wuhan. Let's not forget that. They emerged and built whole hospitals from the ground up in days. They built whole hospitals from the ground up in days. And they basically have been able to break the chain of infection, Ted. My friends in China walk around without masks. Masks are gone for most places, you know. They test all the time. When there was a small fear in one town in northern China that there were 5-6 cases, they tested 11 million people. They tested everybody. In an advanced industrial country, there's no testing. You have to pay money to get tested. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's a public health emergency. The government has to come in and test everybody, contact, trace, isolate those. Don't do full lockdowns. Do it scientifically. Anyway, you look at India, it's a complete opposite. It's a total shambles. I mean, I've already described the shambles for you. But you see, the tragedy is that because India from the 1990s has basically positioned itself as a subordinate ally of the United States. When Obama starts the pivot to Asia, Hillary Clinton goes to Chennai in South India, gives a speech about the new Silk Road Initiative, which was designed to go from India to Central Asia through Afghanistan. The idea was to block both Russian relations with the Central Asian states and to prevent China from building its Silk Road. That was the US plan. That fell apart, but India was at the core of that. Then they tried the Quad, the Quadrilateral Security Initiative. That Quad with India, Australia, Japan, and the United States is very much in evidence. The first meeting of world leaders that Biden had was with the Quad leaders, the virtual meeting that he held. So India is very much in the US camp and has been jingoistic. I mean, the United States didn't ban TikTok, but India has banned TikTok. India has banned these things. India has banned all Chinese apps. So in the middle of the crisis recently, President Xi Jinping of China said, we want to send aid. Now, at the time, India said, fine. But this should be in the normal course, Ted. Last year, when the Chinese were sending aid to other countries, India could have used assistance, you know. India should have been immediately building up oxygen supplies. Every hospital in India should have a small machine that converts natural oxygen into medical oxygen by removing the nitrogen. But we don't have that stuff. You know, 2 train loads of oxygen have come into Delhi because Delhi hospitals have run out of medical oxygen. It's ridiculous. Medical oxygen is not like building a nuclear bomb. And if India can build nuclear bombs, you see, this is the top thing. India is the world's largest importer of weapons. Why are you importing so many weapons? You should be building medical oxygen plants. You should be building schools for people. You should be building schools so reason is introduced into people's lives. Not in the middle of the pandemic, 7 million Indians went to the town of Haridwar to celebrate the Kumbh Mela. 7 million Indians, the biggest super spreader event that you can imagine. They should have prevented that. They should have prevented it. 7 million people gathered. This is not a family of 20 and they call it a super spreader. That synagogue in New York, remember? They said that's a super spreader. This is 7 million people going to bathe in the river at the same time. It's nuts. It's nuts.
And the policy, it would be confusing to try and understand, well, why is the Indian state behaving in this way without a class analysis? You understand that the Indian capitalists are in bed with the global capitalists and have no interest in protecting the lives of Indian people. I want to recommend that people check out your essay, your contributions to Capitalism on a Ventilator, because it goes into so many of these particular issues, particularly the differences in how China and other socialist countries have succeeded in dealing with the pandemic, like you said. It's available for print at bit.ly/capventbook, and you can also get an ebook copy at bit.ly/capventebook. It's a great collection that also has contributions from Ajamu Baraka, from Black Alliance for Peace, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Sarah Flounders, and Lee Siu-Hin, among many, many others. I want to bring on my dear comrade in Texas, Marinda Chrisman, and they have what I thought was a really interesting question about mass incarceration in the U.S. and in India. Marinda, are you with us?
Yeah, greetings from Houston. In Texas and throughout the U.S., the pandemic has especially hit those in the working class who are imprisoned or incarcerated in the inhumane warehouses for the poor and oppressed, known to us as prisons, jails, and detention centers. While the U.S. incarcerates over 2 million people total, or at a rate of 6,390 people per million, India incarcerates nowhere near that, with nearly 500,000 people in prison total, or at a rate of 350 per million. Both countries do have some sort of captive workforces behind the walls of these prisons, jails, and detention centers. I was wondering if, one, you could speak to what this pandemic has been like for those incarcerated in India, and also in the U.S., the continuous policy of colonial criminalization of migration has seen migrant detention facilities for children reopened under the Biden administration on top of toxic waste sites in places like Homestead, Florida, and El Paso, Texas. So the second question is, I remember reading about construction of migrant detention facilities in Assam under Modi back in late 2019, early 2020. So I guess the second question is also, has there been any word of resistance to ongoing brutality behind the walls of prison jails and detention centers in India during COVID?
So firstly, Miranda, this is a very important question and it touches me personally because I have a lot of friends who are behind bars. Gautam Navlaka, my colleague at NewsClick, has been behind bars for a while. Anand Teltumde, who is an author of mine from Leftward Books, is behind bars. They're all political prisoners. Varvara Rao is behind bars. Sudha Bhardwaj is, I'm just naming you political prisoners. These are people who have been organizing against Modi and they just get picked up and thrown in. All kinds of crazy. They were charged with conspiracies to kill Modi, conspiracies to do that, conspiracies to all nonsense, by the way, every one of them. Each one of them is in ill health and in very bad conditions in jail. I mean, look, in many advanced industrial countries, there was some empathy. People went ahead and said, let's vaccinate prisoners, accelerate vaccination of prisoners and so on, because they are wards of the state. Many advanced industries, I don't know in the United States, but many places that was the push. In India, it's the total opposite. Firstly, I want to tell you something about Indian prisons. In India, there are more under trials in prison than there are convicted people in prison. So that means, so that's why the numbers are all crazy, because what you see generally in terms of incarcerated people in India is those who have been sentenced and in jail. But there are more under trials sitting in prison. Do you know why? Because most people suffer from class crimes. In other words, you are too poor to pay bail. Too poor to even bribe a lawyer to make sure you get to court. So there's no habeas corpus nonsense. You're sitting in jail for 20 years waiting for your hearing. You see what I mean? So they are not considered incarcerated in the numbers. So we believe the numbers are higher. That's point one. And the situation is bad, Miranda. You know it, right? If you've got people sitting in cages, essentially, and a virus comes in, where's the isolation? It's insane. It's not going to happen, right? It'll run through a population. So that kind of thing is happening. And because in India, the numbers of those who are dying, we have no clue. The least we'll be told is in prison. I mean, what records they keep, I don't know. I don't think it's to be trusted. Okay, so that's that question. Secondly, this Modi government is basically an effectively socially offensive government. It has deep antipathy to Muslims. And that guides a lot of its social policy. In 2019, when the Modi government came to power, they pushed through a suite of orders and laws. The Citizenship Amendment Act, the National Population Register, and so on. And these were essentially, in many ways, anti-Muslim laws that were put in place. The Citizenship Amendment Act is very interesting because what it suggests is, among India's neighboring countries, minorities can apply to India for asylum. Now, this is interesting. What does it mean? It means that Hindus, Buddhists, Jains, Christians, and others can apply, but not Muslims. Because in the largest countries around India, the Muslims cannot claim to be minorities. So question was raised, what about Ahmadiyyas in Pakistan? They're a persecuted minority in Pakistan, but they happen to be Muslims who are persecuted. Or if I say as a Shia in Pakistan that I feel persecuted, I want asylum in India, why you would apply for asylum in India, I don't know. But you say, I want asylum in India, the government, not under the CAA. So this was effectively an anti-Muslim provision. There was mass demonstration around India. You may have seen this in the area of Shaheen Bagh in Delhi. These women basically created an encampment. Mainly Muslim women sat down and said, forget it, we don't agree. And there was mass demonstration across the country. I addressed a crowd in Calcutta. I couldn't see the end of the crowd. It was that big, huge, enormous demonstration. You know, millions of people on the street across India against this policy. The pandemic came in and there was a communal riot. I would like to let you know that next month from Left Road Books, we are publishing a book called Delhi's Agony, edited by Brinda Karat of the Communist Party of India, Marxist, and myself. It'll have a report done on that pogrom against Muslims in February of last year in Delhi, and essays by the actor Nasiruddin Shah, the musician, singer T.M. Krishnan, Ejaz Ahmed, and others will have essays in it. It's going to be a very fine book. It'll come out next month from Leftward Books. But in this whole period, Miranda, the question of Assam loomed large. Because in Assam, it borders Bangladesh. And there's a lot of scurrilous propaganda about Bangladeshis coming into Assam, Bengalis coming into Assam. And this poses a problem. So the Modi government, in its deep social offensiveness, created these caged prisons, as you say, whatever, to remove people who were not on the books in the National Population Register. And as a consequence of this policy, it deeply divided Assam's society. It deeply divided the society. There was an election in Assam recently, the BJP or Modi's party came back. Because the way they win elections is that they polarize the population on religious lines. And then they hope that a section of the Hindus will galvanize around their standard and they'll win the election. They want to divide the others. And that's what they did in Assam. And they used this thing about foreigners and deportation and all that as an electoral tool. You see, Ted earlier talked about the character of the ruling class. The ruling class has contempt for society. Let's face it, okay? The ruling class has contempt for society. They don't care. Right now, there's $37 trillion sitting in illicit tax havens. $37 trillion sitting in tax havens from Liechtenstein to Dubai to Panama to wherever, right? 37, that's the minimal amount we have been able to find. $37 trillion right now. The total external debt of developing countries, less developed countries and not less developed countries, total external debt is $11 trillion. That's one third, less than one third of the money that the filled with contemptful ruling class has hidden in tax havens, illicit taxes. By the way, this term illicit, it's not my term. It's used by the UN world. It's used in the Basel Convention. You know, the Basel Convention decides on banking regulation. This is not my term. The Basel Convention, they call these tax havens illicit. $37 trillion minimum. They have contempt for the human public. People can't get food in advanced industrial countries. Their relief ends. They don't know how to eat. And these people have squirreled away $37 trillion and we let them get away with it. We agree with this idea that they deserve it. We feel bad suddenly for Bill and Melinda Gates. Oh my God, they're going through a divorce. That's so sad. People wrote, if Bill and Melinda Gates can't make their marriage work, what hope is there for me? Are you crazy? Are you crazy? What kind of, you've lost your mind.
That's why the resistance to capitalism and to empire is really the way of asserting one's dignity. Here in the US, and we are coming to the end of the program, and I thank you so much, comrades, for being with us. But you know, here in the US last year, 30 million people came out onto the streets in response to the horrible murder of George Floyd and against police violence in general, against the white supremacist state. But, you know, we did have one question that if you have time, comrade, I would love for you to speak a little bit about it. And thank you, Marinda, for joining us. Perhaps the largest labor strike action in human history taking place with farmers in India. And I know that there's been a great deal of progressive or revolutionary organization in Kerala. And I wonder if you can speak a little bit about that before we end.
Oh, I would love to, because Ted, you know, why end this story with the contemptful ruling class? I quite like what you're doing. I see what you're doing. Well done. Well played, Ted. Let's quickly mention both of these things. Firstly, for the last decade plus, more than the last decade, the 10 major trade union federations in India have come together to do an annual general strike. And every year, Ted, the general strike has been larger than the previous year. So on the 26th of November, the 10 trade unions and allied farmers and agricultural workers unions came together and said on 26th November, we are going to do a general strike for one day against the three bills pushed through parliament undemocratically, which are anti-farmer, which destroy the state support system and basically privatize farming, and against the two labor ordinances. So 10 trade unions and the farmers' organizations, a range of them. 250 million workers went on strike. This is the number that the government doesn't deny. They won't admit it, okay? But nobody denies it. 250 is the largest strike in world history. Took place on 26 November 2020, in the middle of the pandemic. From that day, around Delhi, tens of thousands of farmers set up encampments. They have not left yet, by the way. They set up encampments on the 26th of November. They are fighting for the withdrawal of these farm bills, for the privatization of the system of food production in India, essentially. On the 26th of January, they broke through the barricades. You got to understand that farmers don't take any shit from anybody. Agricultural workers and farmers, they came with their implements. I mean, after all, where do we get the hammer and sickle from? Where does the sickle come from? It doesn't come from your dad's dream, okay? It comes from the farming, the toolkit of the farmer. That hammer comes from the toolkit of the worker. That's where the hammer and sickle is, the Worker-Peasant Alliance. That was on display on 26 November. Then on 26 January, the farmers smashed the barricades and entered Delhi. Because 26th of January is India's Republic Day. It's when our constitution was brought into play in 1950. So they came and demonstrated in the middle of town. They're refusing to leave because they told Modi that you have to withdraw these three bills. So that is continuing. So that's a national thing. Nationwide struggle against the Modi government by farmers to demand the withdrawal of these three bills. It's not going anywhere. Okay, there's no reconciliation between the two sides. What did Marx write in Capital? Marx wrote in Capital, when equal sides meet, force decides. It's a great line from Capital. When equal sides meet, force decides. You can go and check in Capital. I may not have quoted the first part correctly, but the force decides is correct. When two equal sides meet, force decides. Marx is trying to explain that economic law in a class society doesn't happen the way they teach it in neoclassical economic books. At the end of the day, somebody gets slapped. Either the bourgeoisie slaps the worker or the workers come and they tear the bourgeoisie apart. This is a serious class struggle. Okay, and that's what's happening. Secondly, Kerala is a state, Southwest India, 35 million people. Since 1980, the Kerala government, state government, has oscillated between the communist front, the left democratic front, and the right-wing front, United Democratic Front, both called Democratic Front. Since 1980, they've had 5 years, 5 years, 5 years, 5 years. The last 5 years, it was the left democratic government led by Pinarayi Vijayan, who's a leader of the Communist Party of India, Marxist. Pinarayi Vijayan's government has tackled a cyclone in 2017, two floods, catastrophic floods in 2018, 2019, the Nipah virus, and then the coronavirus. The health minister in Kerala is a retired school teacher. She's known as KK Shalja Teacher. She was amazing. The Guardian, of all terrible publications, profiled her and called her Corona Slayer. They profiled her last year. She's an incredible person. Okay, she gave an interview recently saying, I learned everything about public health from how the Cubans did it. Okay, so this time the government in Kerala had to face an election. Remember, no incumbent has won since 1980, and the party won a thumping majority, 100 out of 140 seats in the legislature. Pinara Vijayan will return as the chief minister of that state. KK Shailja will return as the health minister. People trust them because they are rational. At the same time, the government did all kinds of creative financing. I interviewed the finance minister, T.M. Thomas Isaac. You can watch it if you're interested at the Leftward Books site. I interviewed Thomas Isaac for People's Dispatch as well, asking him, how did you finance all this? Because they improved public education, they improved public health systems. He just said, we just did it, you know? We just did it. We decided we're not going to do crony capitalism. We're just going to build public health, public schools. People want that. We just did it. And, you know, they did a couple of other things. I want to put three things out for you so you understand the depth of communist commitment. Number one, they decided universal broadband. Everybody must have internet access. Already Kerala is 100% electrified. Now, universal broadband, no bullshit about private public partnership, nothing. It's government broadband, everybody. Secondly, the government decided that girls were missing school at a regular level, at the school level, intermediate school level. And they found when they did a study, this was because girls have their periods and they were too embarrassed to come to school because they didn't have technologies, you know, pads and so on. So the government decided in all government schools to have free technologies for girls to deal with their menstruation. And the chief minister openly talked in his press conferences about menstruation. You know, he said, this is a normal thing, you know, this is the human body, we have to deal with it. So we are going to have free dispensaries. And you can do, and the girl school rate went up. It's very important that people need to understand that these are sort of micro political things, but they impact the life of half the population who will become women and so on. And if they lose their schooling, they lose a lot of things in their life. That's a very important innovation of the government. Thirdly, the government decided that transgender population must be given facilities. So in Kochi, the city of Kochi, where we have a metro rail, all ticket collectors were transgender. The idea is that when you buy a ticket, you have to physically have contact with the person. And the idea was that everybody must have physical contact with somebody who's in the transgender community because the stigma has to be broken. Now, you can have a criticism, say, oh my God, this is that, it's, you know, whatever. I don't care. This was a very innovative way to try to break stigma. This is the reason why a government gets reelected. You know, there's a section of the population that hates the government. They are conservatives, traditionalists. They don't want anybody to talk about menstruation or transgender. They find this thing, what the hell? That's part of human life. What did the old man write? The old man wrote, nothing human is alien to me. We just celebrated the old man's birthday on May 5th. Nothing human is alien to me. Neither menstruation nor transgender. No, of course, public education and a public sector.
And what a brilliant way to use that quote in the current context, too, as a way of asserting the humanity of our trans brothers, sisters, and siblings, and everyone who menstruates as well. I mean, that's the gains of the state of Kerala and the organization there are truly provided another model for how to move forward. Comrade, I cannot thank you enough for joining us. I was speaking to Dr. Robin Kelly just a couple of days ago, who wanted to come on and ask a question as a surprise, but unfortunately he's teaching right now. But he asked me to ask you, how did you get Evo Morales to write the foreword to your latest book, Washington Bullets?
Well, that's a very good question, but it's a simple answer. The answer is that when the coup was happening in Bolivia, I'm very close to our comrades in the mass movement in Bolivia, and we got word that something is happening, and I called up Noam Chomsky and said, Noam, you need to have a statement about this because, you know, we got to raise awareness. This episode. Noam and I published a statement. It was published the next day in newspapers in South America. The coup hadn't happened yet. The call I got actually said that they are coming tonight to kill Evo. This is a serious business. And I thought, my God, that's appalling. And so we released this statement, and suddenly I was following this minute to minute. When Williams Kalimann comes in to see Evo, my heart was in my mouth. I thought, oh my God, they will arrest him or something. But Kalimann fortunately said to Evo, you got to just resign. And what was really, really disturbing to me, Ted, is in that in the advanced industrial north in Canada, the United States, Europe, and so on, people on the left started to say, well, he's overstayed his welcome. This is an indigenous leader of a country in the Americas. Okay, let's first deal with that. Okay, he's an indigenous leader in a country in the Americas, which has butchered the indigenous people for the past over 500 years. Secondly, he was in office less time than Angela Merkel was the Chancellor of Germany, but that's okay. This indigenous man, get him out of there. So disrespectful and racist in the way. Secondly, people in the West, you know, even progressive type people, liberal type people, you know, said that, well, it was not a coup. You know, he resigned, it was not a coup. That really pissed me off. So I sat down in January and February of 2020 and I wrote this book. I don't think I've written a book this fast. I was up very late, a lot of nicotine, a lot of caffeine, and I wrote this book in a hurry because partly I've been writing this book all my life. I've been interviewing people about this all my life. When Evo Morales heard the book was being written, he was interested. And when he read the Spanish part, he said, oh, I'll write the foreword. And he wrote an amazing foreword because in the foreword, he wrote that, you know, if you stand with the people, you will prevail. And then like a month after the book came out, the first polls came showing that Mas would return to power. And eventually, a year after the coup in October of last year, Luis Arce and David Chukwuemeka won the election. And at the time, Evo Morales walked across the border from Argentina to Bolivia. And that was one of the best days of my life, you know. And then to see Evo in Caracas after that and to see his confidence and his sense that, you know, we will prevail. Because we will. Because the ruling class is shit, you know. It's a shit. You just can't believe them anymore.
No.
They're a shit, you know. We've got to do something else. We've got to be a little more confident. You know, I don't mean we need to be arrogant. I don't mean that at all. But we have to be confident. We can't believe these people. You know, we just can't.
And it comes down to a certain level, the bare minimum self-respect to stop taking their bullshit. And what a great victory that the Bolivian people were able to provide to the global working class by defeating that fascist coup. So there, we did end it on a positive note. But we have a great deal of work to do still. Comrade Vijay Prashad, thank you so much for joining us today. Be safe and keep your health, and thank you. We'll talk again soon.
Take care of yourself. And by the way, I'm happy to be here because I remembered my old friend, Bill Bateman.
There you go.
I once sat in Rhode Island with a sign that said jobs for all. And it was a jobs campaign and people came thinking we were giving out jobs. And Bill has such a great sense of humor about it. I'm glad to be back with Workers World on this. Okay. Thanks, Ted. See you later.
We also learned a little bit about your former career as a house painter.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Thanks, comrade. If you liked this conversation tonight, please consider joining a revolutionary socialist organization like Workers World. If you go to workers.org/join, you can fill out the form that's online there, and one of our organizers will be in touch. I just want to thank everyone for joining us tonight and say, build a workers' world.